The Coptimizer podcast is being powered by Axon Coaching. Axon Coaching was purpose-built for today's public safety employees to help them accomplish goals and live better. What is it, you ask? One-on-one video-based coaching with officers who have been in your shoes and know firsthand what it means to live and work in public safety. The program will connect you with certified coaches who combine their years of success from the world of law enforcement with world-class training from Axon. Get the support, resources, motivation you need to live the life you want. Axon coaches are relatable, knowledgeable, and confidential. And most importantly, they get results. Why should the keys to unlocking our peak performance be reserved for just the boardroom or the playing field? Unleash your full potential today and get started with Axon Coaching. Log into axon-coaching.com and learn more about how to bring this program to your agency and community. So, enough of that. It's time to Coptimize. Hi, good morning. Welcome to the Coptimizer podcast, Todd. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's always good to be with you, Pat. Hope things are going well.
Well, you know, this is a new endeavor for me. You and I have had a lot of lengthy conversations. We're going to keep this one a little bit shorter today. Anyone that knows me, they're probably worried about the length of this podcast, but we're not going for a Rogan or Jocko length here. We're going to try to keep this to about 45 minutes, hit on some key highlights, and really hopefully pick your brain a little bit and get some great lessons learned from your life, from your career, which is pretty amazing, quite frankly. And so enough about that. Let's talk about you. Can you give us maybe just a little bit of background, introduce yourself to our audience? And I think pretty quickly they'll understand why you're a proper and a very appropriate early guest on the Coptimizer podcast.
Well, I appreciate that. I think it's more about, you know, maybe being a good survivor and being surrounded by really good mentors than anything else. But I'm happy to share whatever I can about my own experiences. I'm from Indiana. I was in the infantry National Guard as a private through sergeant while I was going through college. Came out of Purdue University, was commissioned infantry as an officer in the regular Army, and just really had a standard conventional type of career up through captain. Was fortunate enough to have three company commands, including a reconnaissance troop. It was assessed to be a fairly successful career up to that point. I was assigned to be a senior observer controller at the National Training Center, which really gave me a solid fundamental understanding of training methodology and what that means to really helping coach, mentor, and teach through a lot of repetition, by the way, and nothing like a lot of tank-on-tank fighting for, about 25 days out of 30 days every single month for 3 years.
Yeah, well, you know, that's where most of us learn is in tank battles.
There's nothing like a live fire of tanks and artillery. Yeah, I was a live fighter most of my career prior to that. So it was kind of eye-opening. I'll tell you one thing from that perspective is that they understand detailed planning much, much better than a lot of other, you know, communities did at that time in the Department of the Army. But I was there also when 9/11 happened. Just like many other people, you know, we remember exactly where we were and what was going on. I was doing an after-action review prep for a brigade that had just completed their rotation. And, you know, at that time, you know pretty much what's going to happen to you in your career as you go from captain major, which for me would have been staff as an operations officer or as an executive officer. And then maybe I've been fortunate enough to get battalion command. And I just did not see that for me wanting to really be sidelined during the global war on terror. So I did put in a couple of packets for special operations. I was fortunate enough to be picked up with one. For one of the whatever reason, I was able to make it through the board evaluation and the IQ tests and, you know, everything else you could imagine. And I can't really describe exactly what I went through, but I can tell you that I went through an extensive course that certified me to conduct sensitive operations on behalf of the national government. I was still an active duty officer and was sent back to do clandestine operation on behalf of our tier one forces. So that led me into being one of the first on the ground in Iraq, conducting close tactical reconnaissance, preparation for hostage rescue, working with our special forces on establishing other counterterrorism units. That went from singleton operator type of missions throughout the Middle East into becoming a troop commander, and then becoming in charge of all of the northern Iraq for our sense of operations for some time period. I left service as a major, was fortunate enough to receive a couple of Bronze Stars for what I had done, and then was assigned as a senior advisor to a different, at the time, special mission unit called the Asymmetric Warfare Group. They since were not, after that, they became not a special mission unit anymore. But at that time they were, and really what I had a lot of focus on was, from my background experiences, was providing support to sensitive activities. And what that meant in support of both special operations forces and conventional forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then transitioned from that into being a senior operational troop advisor, where it was a lot of direct combat supported opportunities, again, for both our special operations forces, special mission units, and our conventional forces. So through that time period, it's unfortunate, but I had over 11, almost 12 years of deployment into the combat zone and roughly 6.5 years of direct combat time.
Well, that's a lot. So let's start to break that down just a little bit and go back. A lot of us, that are in this age range, we'll say 40 to 60 age range, have a pretty strong recollection of 9/11. So when you say, hey, we all remember where we were and what you were doing, what were you doing that day?
I was in a smaller conference room reviewing live fire training video and what it meant to integrate and synchronize collection assets so that you had more precision strike capability. And I was sitting with most of the brigade observer controller team to, determine what we're going to put together for our final after action review for a brigade. And we happened to have CNN or another news network was being projected onto a side screen. So we were watching live as the towers were being hit and falling.
And so in your position, knowing what you're doing in service for your country, what's that emotion like? What's that feeling that you get when you see something like that occur?
It's probably a drop in the pit of your stomach, a total sense of dread. And be just being overwhelmed, almost like maybe a some type of fear of drowning, maybe if that could equate it. But to be quite honest, at the same time, a lot of immediate anger and desire to seek revenge.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I've asked a lot of people that question over the years, and I've gone back and revisited that moment myself. For me, I was working the midnight shifts, and I was supposed to be in court that day. So I had left work early and got to bed and was asleep. And when my phone rang, and it was one of my lifelong friends who is generally what I'll describe as a pacifist, great, great person, great human being. I've known him my whole life, but I knew something was wrong immediately when he started yelling at me over the phone. Are you watching the TV? Are you watching the TV? And I'm like, no, I'm asleep, dude. So he's like, you got to get up and watch the TV. So when I got up and, walked downstairs because didn't have a TV in my bedroom, and I couldn't just turn it on my phone either. We didn't have iPhones back then. But yeah, that was a sinking feeling. I think the way you describe it, I think is pretty visceral, like almost like that feeling like I'm
I'm drowning, or and then the anger does hit. And, you know, I was actually surprised that my friend was a little bit angrier than I was. But, you know, I only bring that up I bring it up for a couple of reasons. One, you know, one of the things that we're going to talk about a little bit on this podcast today is, you know, when we're talking about peak performance and when we're talking about how do you make the most of your day, one of the biggest challenges I think that we all have is just managing emotions and, you know, understanding where they're coming from and then how they impact us, how they impact our decision making. And it's, that day, I like to use that as an example because I think everybody, can go back to that moment and quickly and kind of recognize, hey, this is what it feels like to be scared, to be sad, to be angry and frustrated all in the same moment. And then really, how do you absorb those emotions and then move on with your day? So, you know, for me as a police officer at the time, you know, retired now, but that, you know, I was a field training officer and I had a recruit officer with me that night. And, you know, it was, you know, there was one of my first real struggles with, you know, how do I focus on a task in the moment when in my mind I'm very distracted, and it's critical that I stay present and focus on what needs to be done. Otherwise, you know, I can put myself in jeopardy, and I could certainly put my someone who's relying on me to train them in jeopardy. And, you know, I'd like to say that I managed it well, but I didn't. So I think, like a lot of people, you know, I was focused on things that I had no control over in those moments. So I think just to kind of set the tone for, you know, what the type of things that we want to talk about in this podcast, it's a great way to set it up. So yeah, you use a lot of big words, and most people probably aren't going to recognize, you know, what is a singleton operator anyway?
Well, it is somewhat unique, and I'm trying to dance around some classifications. I really try to make sure that I'm honoring to a non-disclosure agreement that I have with the federal government.
Well, that's good, because I don't, you're not the type of person. I don't want you trouble, to, right? Yeah, I don't want you to come after me.
Showing up in our backyard. So typically, you know, whenever you work in the military, you work in some type of team concept. Even if it is a squad of infantry, that would be two teams of four individuals with a squad leader in charge. So you'd have a team leader, et cetera. So you'd have 3 to 4 times 2 plus a leader. Even when you work within special forces, that is a 12 person element. And it'll be certainly broken down into a couple of teams with additional leaders. Within special operations, at the let's call it the tier one element level, which is, you know, directed specifically for a national level mission, either by the President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, or the Secretary of your actual service component, like the Secretary of the Army. When you operate to those levels, often still you're going to operate as probably some type of four-person element. So even our close quarter battle at the special operations level, it is predominantly focused on a team dynamic. When you were doing the type of activities that I was doing, more than likely you're doing it completely by yourself. You were at high risk of compromise or capture. You also had to, you know, really have and maintain extremely good situational awareness. And you have to have survival skills. I'm not trying to advocate that as a single operator, that means that automatically you're a John Wick or Jason Bourne or anything like that. I'm not trying to say I am the close quarter battle or, you know, pistolero. But it is different in terms of risk and what it means to how you operate. You really got to think more of like a global scout mindset and just be very aware of what's going on around you, because nobody's going to come back to help you. Nobody's going to get there in time to rescue you. So singleton operator is really somebody that would be able to operate on their own, often undercover or alias, and then be able to gain the intelligence needed to do follow-on actions like a direct action raid or, you know, some other type of operation like a you know, like a some type of capture opportunity. So you really got to have detailed planning. You have to have extremely good rehearsals. You have to keep up on your perishable skills, like reacting to and confronting an ambush situation. And you do have to have pretty good individual survival capabilities.
With that in mind, I mean, to me, what I hear there is you have to have a very high level of confidence in your individual capabilities. And, you know, with confidence, you know, in those skills come, you know, basically you have to be competent, right? And with competence comes confidence. What would be your recommendation let's just say someone who's thinking about, okay, how, you know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be to survive behind enemy lines in a hostile environment. How do I prepare myself for a day where I know there's going to be stress involved? So what are some of the things that you do personally to help manage those emotions and to help you be able to think clearly in times when you're under that type of stress?
Well, that's a hard question, Pat. Now, first I'll tell you on this is that when we talk about confidence versus competence, on confidence, I would say I never probably had the highest level of confidence, and certainly not because I wasn't trying or, you know, wasn't ready to face whatever might happen. It was really just based on people I was surrounded with, by. I've known Delta unit members that have silver stars. I know a guy that had 6 bronze stars for valor. These are the kind of people I grew up with over 20 years. And when you're surrounded by people like that, often it isn't about, well, you know, I'm not sure I'm as good as they are, but you don't ever want to let down your brothers and sisters in a combat situation. So it really pushes you to do the best you possibly can. The second thing, if you want to talk later about it, is about, you talk about controlling your emotions. And that was a difficult one to learn. Certainly in this type of community that I'm talking about, you really always going to have your game face on. And at some certain time after that, it just becomes the reality. A lot of people think that means you're mean or that you're abrupt or whatever it is. It's really the end. It's about controlling your emotions. But some of that, you know, for me, I'm not going to call it a facade. I'll just tell you, at some certain point, when you don't have a release valve because you're under an extreme amount of stress, you know, I've been in numerous firefights. I've been blown up a couple of times. I've seen a lot of good men and women die, and I've seen a lot of innocent people killed. It carries a weight. And so at some certain points, you're not going to control your emotions, and that does not turn out good for you, your family, or your career. So I'll tell you that I'm not the best person at times because I've not been able to control 100% of my emotion. But in the end, when you talk about the competence piece of that, I've gone through several selections to include some of the most difficult shooting lines that I've seen for qualification to get in some other units that I've been a part of. And there's only one way to do that. And that's one, dedicate 100% of your time to being committed to see it through. You can't quit. You can't give up. And then really for me, it was about repetition. And I've had recent discussions on this because there's a lot of political debate about, is this course good or is that one good? Or should we throw everything away because of how we responded recently to active shooters? And I'll tell you, it doesn't matter what your solution is. If you only visit it one time and then you put it on a shelf, it's a perishable skill and you're not going to be good at it when you need to be. So frequency of your individual skills is extremely important. You have to train on it and you have to have that frequency that allows you to build up your capabilities so you can get to a competency level.
Well, yeah, you're going to make me jump ahead because that was another brilliant segue into, you know, some of the, I think, the discussion that I really wanted to touch on today, because we get into these conversations all the time in public safety, particularly in law enforcement, these warrior guardian conversations in the, you know, I like to go back to Ferguson, to where, you know, we really started to see a lot of these questions start to surface about the role of law enforcement, what we're supposed to be doing in our communities. And, you know, some of the things that you just touched on are, you know, I think maybe the general public at times doesn't recognize this, but the, you know, police officers experience a lot of the same things that you were just talking about. It doesn't matter if you're a 6-month patrol officer in a new department in a small community, or, you know, whether you're in a major metropolitan area, you know, the problems are the same, and it's really a matter of scale. And police officers do witness really a lot of the worst of what the human race has to offer. They see, you know, they're dealing with people in their moments of stress, in their moments of crisis, in their moments of need. And when people, quite frankly, just are not at their best, it doesn't necessarily, you know, I don't mean to say that people are bad, but, you know, there's a role specific for officers when they arrive in moments where there are bad things that are happening. And a lot of times that is death and destruction, whether it's at the hands of another person, whether it's a tragic accident, whether it's an intentional act. There, you know, you see a lot, you witness a lot, and you really have to be prepared for a lot of different things when you're at work. You know, it's been said that it's, you know, hours and hours of sheer boredom, you know, interrupted by moments of, you know, of sheer terror. And it's interesting to say the least. But that's, you know, your experiences clearly at a level and at a scale that most are not going to experience. And so I'm curious, you know, when you we certainly don't have to talk too much about what your past experiences are. One of the things I really want to focus on is what was it about the things that you learned and the things that you did that made you want to come back into the public sector in civilian life and take these lessons learned and apply them to make community safer. And so maybe let's shift and just talk a little bit about that. And, you know, eventually we can get into the school shooter stuff.
Okay. Yeah. You know, it's part of what you said, though, it might be a little bit long winded, but I got to tell you, because you talked about something that's always kind of been there for me. Maybe it's a part of my motivation. For me, it was a little bit easier. I'm going to say it in that way, because I had a defined enemy set. They were the foreigners compared to us. And that made it easier to segment that away and then put, you know, partition that into my mind when it came to do something hostile. It made it even easier to grasp it with when you saw horrific things like the enemy doing some pretty bad things to innocent people. So it made it some ways motivating to do your job, but also you were able to compartment it better. I have a high respect for law enforcement. I'm not saying that every one of them does 100% right. Certainly, I think there's always room for improvement in any organization, but I have never had to go home wondering what is wrong with our own society when I've witnessed something terrible and have to face that on a daily basis like our law enforcement or our other first responders do. And I give them extreme amount of credibility and respect for that. And I think that our society's even completely forgotten that. You know, what is it like to go home every night knowing and wondering, kind of like a WTF moment, why am I facing this part of our society? What's wrong with us that this kind of stuff happens? So I don't think we give enough understanding and empathy towards our police officers for that kind of, you know, situations that they have to face. But for why did I get, maybe that's why I say maybe that's a part of it is that, you know, the last, you know, after I left the last Department of Defense career that I had, I went into, let's just say, the intelligence community for another 6 years. And so I was doing a lot of more high threat meeting type of things against terrorists, you know, a lot of things that unfortunately we just can't discuss here. In some ways, it was good as a transition because I also had a little bit more time on my hands. But I've carried a lot of survival guilt. You know, part of probably my PTSD is that I've seen some things that I wish I had done better, or I'm always reflecting back upon what could have been done better to save some of those people's lives. And when I look, and we certainly at that same time period in my life, you and I had a chance to meet in our community, and we gravitated towards these same type of discussions. And what I started seeing is that from my experiences in doing what I used to do, And what I see within our own, you know, kind of first responder community, the challenges we face, even though they are somewhat different missions, that the challenges we face are quite often the exact same things, especially on the leadership side. And what I hoped, at least in some ways, was is from the mistakes I have made, because I've made some big ones. I'm at least hopeful that what I can do is share what I've experienced in some ways to others so that they can take that on in consideration and hopefully improve themselves, save their lives, as well as save other people's lives. So, you know, I'm not going to be altruistic and say it's all about community. In some ways, I just want to make sure that, you know, for the chance I have to be here still today with my family, that I'm paying that back to others.
Well, and we certainly appreciate that, because it's been, you know, honestly, you know, a great pleasure for me to get to know you. And one of the things that I wanted to discuss today too was one of the first conversations that we had, and that when you were looking to make the switch back to civilian life, you were talking about some of the experiences that you had, and again, we were talking about data, right? And you know, how do you use data? How do you make decisions? And we don't need to go into all the specific details about it, but I probably should have told you I was going to do this. But you know, I remember you told me that you're like, hey, you know what? When we were talking about this attack the network methodology,
Page.
You're telling me, you know what? There's some of the things that we did, you know, or talked about and discussed in this book. So it's been a while since I read the book, but I wanted to at least break it out and show it to you. Because, you know, in the end, I think this is incredibly important, you know, especially in today's law enforcement, we are overtasking and, underfunding, under resourcing our public safety.
Big time.
And it's that, you know, is very problematic, and it creates all kinds of challenges. As a police administrator, you know, you have a tremendous responsibility to your community, but you also have a responsibility to your troops, you know, for your officers, for, you know, and that's your civilian and sworn staff, you know, because it takes everybody to make a police department work. And the environment that we started to see back when we first met, you know, which was, you know, not long after the events in Ferguson, you know, that's where we really started to see this erosion of trust between communities and police departments. You know, one of the first lessons that I learned as a chief was that, you know, sometimes your story is going to be told. Well, I should say it's always going to be told, but very rarely is it told from the viewpoint of the police officer and the experiences on the street, what, you know, through their training and through their lens. It's really told publicly through, you know, that media perspective from a neutral and detached perspective that really doesn't, you know, in most cases, it's been my experience that they don't understand. There are a few out there, I think, that get it and do a pretty good job. But, you know, for modern America, most of what people expect and see, you know, and I'm sure it's the same way for a special operations soldier, right? It's in police is where we glorify a lot of things in media productions. You know, we create these personas and these images, and then a lot of people feel like, hey, that's really how it works, and that's how it's done. So if there is an officer involved shooting, some of the questions you get, well, why didn't you just shoot him in the leg? You know, and that's a couple hour conversation about why that's, you know, that's not, you know, it's not a responsible or a practical thing to do. And that can create some frustration. And then, in a more nefarious way, when your story is being told by someone that does carry, you know, maybe an anti-police sentiment or a complete lack of context on how police operations work, you know, it can be really damaging to a community in a department. And, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with media members over the years, and that's, and I've been fortunate to have good relationships and have good candid conversations. They were not always the best conversations, but they were good. And one time I pointed out that the persona of the police is shaped, by what people see in the media and by what people write and report on. It's not necessarily, it's not shaped by what we actually do. And so if there is a disconnect there, that can erode trust. What we've seen since that time is it's been more and more difficult to recruit. Like, the numbers of people coming into the profession have dwindled significantly. The quality of the applicants, we're still finding good applicants, but it's requiring a lot more time and effort and to get them. And we're finding just generationally, officers are not wanting to stay in the profession as a career like they used to. There's still a good number that do, but we see a growing number of officers that leave the profession in the first 3 years, where they realize, hey, this isn't for me. This isn't what I thought it was going to be. So I'm going to go do something else, which, isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it does create, stress on organizations when you're running 10%, 15%, 20% short of what your staffing should be. So it creates a big challenge in that trust component is a big part of it. But what we started in these conversations, a long way of saying, is I was very interested in the way that you were looking at data and the way that you looked at information, and because it was similar to what we were doing in our comms, what we call a comstat, or eventually what we landed on, the analysis and response was, what does data mean to us, and how do we use this? So I'll shut up for a second and, let you bring maybe some of your experiences. And that's, I think, maybe helped shape where you are today as well in terms of where you landed in your, product development.
It's a lot to unwind, Pat, but I think fundamentally I'm trying to get around. And I think probably the fundamental thing to talk about is this spectrum. So maybe if I can get it on screen, right, it's like at one side, I've got to have situational awareness. And what I would say is situational awareness is, do I have the ability to relate to what has happened to me and my organization and my community now and all the way back in the past? So anything that may have happened that could be relevant to the situation 5, 10, 20 years ago, all the way up to what happened 3 seconds ago. If I can rapidly pull that data, which means, one, I have to collect the data, and then I can portray that data in a way that allows me to reflect what is going on, that's situational awareness. The problem is that only allows you to be reactive, not proactive. And so what you have to go beyond situational awareness, that's only one key to the part of success for leaders, and even all the way down to the singleton operator level or the patrol officer on the street. And a good example of situational awareness is a common operating picture. And imagine it being a map that has overlays that I can turn on and off, and they're all color coded. So maybe one color is crime, one color is, let's say, property values, and another one is about trafficability and where there are major accidents at, whatever the data can be. It can be any data you want. And as long as I can overlay those, I can start looking for trends. When I can take away from situational awareness, if I can say, do I have a common operating picture that allows me to graphically reflect the data? That is great. And I'll say that in the civilian world, or at least in the non-military side, we are still grappling with the challenge of how do we do a common operating picture? Because it takes analysis. It takes people dedicated to doing it. You got to collect the information. You got to be able to retrieve the information. And you have to have a good visual representation of that data. Then you got to have leaders to understand what to do with it. And that's the second part. A common operating picture in a some type of operation center is only 50% of the equation. And a lot of people right now are saying, I've got this capability, and they think that that's good to go. Trust me, that's not going to help you nearly as much as what you think it's going to help. You have to take situational awareness. That's the 50%. So what's the other 50%? That's situational understanding. So in situational understanding, it is being able to do some type of trend analysis of that data to say, all of this information in one area really seems to be related. There's some type of relationship here. Or maybe there's no data at all. And it's like, there's data all over the place, and yet there's a gaping black hole right here. Why? So there's some type of inverse relationship to the data. When you can establish that trend in data, you would then look at that in comparison to historical capabilities of whatever activity you're looking at. Are the historical modus operandi of a criminal threat, i.e. a drug ring, or how they're selling drugs on the street, or maybe sexual trafficking, or maybe just routine burglary. Whatever it is, you'd be able to look at it and say, okay, there's some type of traditional playbook of how they're doing their activity. One of the arguments we used to have very early on after 9/11 was, well, you can't do templating of terrorists. You can't do templating of an insurgency. Yes, you can. All you got to do is look at historical data and then come up with the general terms. So once you take your common operating picture, you look at the historic, you look at your trends, you compare that against the playbook of a threat, and you say, am I corroborating what is going on here, or does it look totally different? And what information am I missing to fill in the gaps? That drives your collection. That drives, should be driving, what you're doing for patrol. Should you really just be going out for presence patrols in your beat or district so that people see you out there to deter crime? Or are you out there with a purpose to collect additional information that allows you to fill in the missing gaps to what you're trying to do for a greater crime prevention strategy? Once you have an informed decision through collection of information that fills in the blanks from the common operating picture and your trends analysis, you can start to prioritize your actions where you want to go. I have a biggest problem in this area with this, and this is how I'm going to dedicate my resources. We call this targeted operations or focused operations in the military. It is where you put all of your resources towards handling one problem. And then you just have an assessment phase. You go out and you initiate some type of engagement. It could be, you know, targeted arrests. It could be community outreach. It does not have to be the end of the stick, taser, or the gun. It can be just, I need to outreach with people to communicate with them better that we think there's a problem here and we want their help. You put all that together, and when you come back, you have some type of performance measures or metrics that allow you to analyze and say, did we achieve what we really wanted to achieve? Because we do have a problem of, I built a great bridge. Look at me. I've got good metrics to show that, you know, we've got tons of arrests maybe, but were they the right arrests at the right time that corrected the problem? So did we build the bridge over the right place with the right road to get us to our destination? And you assess it, and then you go back, and that just drives, do I have a better common operating picture, and do I need to refine my collection activities out of it? When you understand the relationship of situational awareness to understanding, which is really that transition, I believe you and I talked early on about CompStat, computer statistics modeling, compared to intelligence-led policing, that is where I think we need to gravitate more discussion on, is we need to take these lessons learned and apply that back towards a greater crime prevention strategy.
Yeah, so this... to make the military comparison, in the early days of particularly in Iraq, when you're going after high value targets, it was a very force fronted operation, dynamic entries, blowing things up, grabbing people, and then leaving. You know, we pat ourselves on the back, mission accomplished. But we're leaving a wake of destruction, you know, behind us. And, you know, policing did, you know, we made some of the same mistakes where you take these approaches, saturation patrols, you go into areas, you stop everything that's moving, you question people, and you're doing it for all the right reasons. But when you're operating in an environment where people don't understand what your objectives are, everybody feels like they're part of the problem. And you lose the ability to build relationships and both these worlds, the currency is information. That's what we're all looking for. And the better the information that you have, the sooner you can act. It becomes, you know, more actionable with better sources. So, you know, we learn those lessons in law enforcement. And I you know, I can't speak for all agencies, but I know that that was, you know, it was a big part of, you know, an adjustment that we looked to make is it's not just going into these areas with saturation or patrols, but being very surgical about it and doing things like going and door knocking, canvassing areas and asking people what their problems are. Eventually switching to a more digital version of that through Nextdoor and other electronic means to be able to collect and begin to, you know, formulate what some of the problems are and quite frankly, just make decisions about what we think we can impact that's going to drive value for our organization. And so that's really fascinating.
If I can jump in on that, you know, and it, not to segue or to cut you off on it, but I didn't want to forget on it because I think it's important to some of what we saw in special ops at the very beginning and the transition to conventional forces, because obviously special operations has a lot of resources, but they're a small surgical precision strike capability, and you can only do so much. And my sidebar is, yes, we left a lot of mess for the conventional forces that own the battle space to say, when we would get done doing a night raid on a high value individual, we would leave for them to clean up the mess of the sentiment of the people whose lives we had disrupted. So we learned a lot about that. And we learned that we needed to balance our capabilities. So we needed to take our non-lethal capabilities, like our community outreach and incentive-based programs and strategic communications. We needed to have that integrated along with our lethal force capabilities. And I see that in the same way, even all the way up to Uvalde. One of the things I've posted about several times and I have a concern about is this difference between integrating assets, meaning I have all the available capabilities I need to handle a problem, but I don't know how to synchronize their efforts. I don't know the right place and time to integrate them or synchronize their efforts so that I'm efficient. And when I don't have efficiency, I start creating chaos. And when I start getting chaos, I start losing control. And I think that's a significant problem. So a good example would be is, okay, I've got every asset out there. I've got community outreach going on. I've got liaison over here. I've got drug task force and counter narcotic operations going on. And then I got patrol over here. Well, that's integration, but that's not synchronization unless they're all oriented on the same problem set. And I think there's a lot of room for discussion on how we do that. And that goes all the way from crime prevention strategy at the department and community level of a city, all the way back down to what it means to patrol for let's say if you're going to do a hostile warrant search on somebody that could turn out to be a barricaded suspect, or it turns into a hostage negotiation. All of that has to go into integration and synchronization of assets.
Yeah. And so since you mentioned Uvalde, well, I don't necessarily know that we need to talk too much about that. I think it's just probably the most recent example of crises that are, you know, that have the potential to pop up in any city anywhere in America, you know, sadly, much too frequently. A lot of reasons why. But, you know, the interesting thing, again, is with the way that digital information has changed, the way that people are receiving news and information, good, bad, or indifferent. You know, it good news, bad news, it travels the world in literally in seconds. And people make snap judgments about, what is good and what is bad. And for police departments, to touch on what we were talking about earlier, you know, it doesn't matter what uniform you're wearing, what color it is, we're all being judged the same way, and by the same standard. Sometimes I think we meet and exceed that standard. Sometimes I think we fall short. You know, that's not to say that people don't have good intentions or, you know, people are out trying to do a bad job, but I think, you know, we saw that, with the Chauvin case. We see it, you know, in these active shooter cases and a lot of other use of force cases in between. And so when you talk about training and you talk about synchronization of efforts, that's an area where, you know, we always have room for improvement on, because we're learning every day about what works well and what doesn't work well. And I think as long as we're open-minded and we're, you know, and And we do approach every day with the mindset that there is something more for me to learn, that I don't know everything yet, because, you know, even at 27 years and at 10 years as, you know, as a chief myself, every day I felt like there was something that I needed to learn. And it wasn't what I knew that bothered me. It was really what I didn't know that I was going to be faced with. So that was, you know, that was really kind of how I approached my day. And we'll spend the last couple of minutes here just talking about your approach now and what you're doing to help public safety in this space of crisis response. And it's really about training leaders in an environment that where we can get great repetition. We can learn from events that have happened based on statistical probabilities. It's not guessing. And we can do it in an environment where we can include a lot of people. So I know we're running short on time for you, and we're going to call this part one because we're going to have to come back for part two and touch on about 100 other things that I wanted to talk about today.
Well, 2, 3, 4, and 5, if you give me a chance to talk about the company. Yeah, you'll have to edit it out. So what we tried to do, and certainly you were very influential from the beginning of the creation of my company, Crisis Response Leader Training. And what we wanted to do, from what I at least hope, is that we understood that, you know, there's good training programs out there. Advanced Law Enforcement, Rapid Response Training Center out of Texas State University. There are certainly, the FBI has got some outstanding programs. State level often has some type of focused type of training. I'm not trying to bash anybody's approach that's out there, other than to say that I think we have a fallacy in assuming that through some type of initial accreditation or even a train-to-trainer program, that they're going to go back and they're going to spread that information. I think we're seeing now, we realize that, you know, you can have an outstanding lesson plan, but if you don't have frequency and engagement, you're not going to retain the information for when you need it. So even back from the early days, you could understand that, you know, let's say that one of my shooting lines is I have to stand at a certain distance from the target. I'm in concealed carry position, abdomen carry, and I have to, from the sound of the buzzer, do a draw and put 2 rounds center of mass in less than 2 seconds, and I can't fail to do that. That takes 10,000 repetitions of muscle memory to get to that point. So why do we think that it's any different with leadership decision-making while under duress? You have to practice your brain and your critical decision-making process the same way you do any other type of muscle memory or critical skill. So with that thought process in mind, on anybody's capability to establish a great lesson plan, we know that you can't just do it one time. You have to revisit the material, and you have to make it more complex every time you address the problem in order to get better at it. That's how you improve critical decision-making. So we took the ability of creating an existing video game engine, significantly modified it to read data from any national reference. We take those data tables and we allow that to read our hybrid AI within the video game to give you what you call that statistical probability of outcome. So as you make any decision as a responder, school faculty member, business owner, whoever it may be that you're playing as a participant, the threat and the civilians that are surrounding you will read your decisions and determine most likely, but what we have from what we have out of case studies and data, this is most likely what's going to happen. So what we've developed is a 3D engaging environment that is very similar to chess, but is really about societal issues of what we're facing right now, which, you know, in the community, we would call that incident command or incident management. So we are trying to do that in a way that is cost effective for any department, organization, school, business owner to have this and utilize as many times per year as they want, so that they can look at their emergency action plan, think about, I didn't realize that might be a potential outcome. I need to modify my plan, and then I need to train on it. I need to gather the correct amount of resources to make sure I'm prepared for that contingency. And that is where I think we've got a problem right now. We have outstanding training programs out there, but they're extremely expensive, and I don't have the opportunity to go to them more than maybe once in my lifetime, if maybe once every 3 or 4 years, which is just not even going to come close to what we need to do to be prepared. So our focus of CRLT was to shift that paradigm to the point of give you as much opportunity to really go through critical leadership decision-making as possible so you can be better prepared.
I know we're right up against our time, and I think that's a perfect segue for one thing I'll say in closing, in that And to take that, the individual skill set into the team environment and put it, you know, and put it into action, because that's what, you know, that's what we need, right? We need good outcomes that are action oriented, but that comes through preparation, confidence, through competence. And you know, from a law enforcement perspective, we're very good at teaching some of these tactical and technical skills. Well, one area where I feel like we've got a lot to learn and a lot of area of improvement is the individual peak performance. You know, how do you train the officer to have the mindset of the singleton operator? How do you build that resiliency in them? And that's you know, you're a prime example of what's possible when you take a person that is passionate about what they're doing. They have a clear purpose in mind, and they're mission and action oriented. And I really appreciate you spending a few minutes with me today. We'll leave it at that for today, but we'll just say this is the end of discussion number one, and we'll pick up discussion number two down the road. But we'll put some information in the show notes. And, you know, one of the things in closing, Todd doesn't, you know, he won't talk about this, but I'm going to talk about it. So in addition to his mention of being in this book, he's also the author of of three fantasy fiction novels that I'm still trying to figure out, you know, how he found the time to do this. So that's going to be part two, is how do you manage to get all this stuff done? It seems like there's always things that you have going on. And in closing, I just wanted to read the dedication in your third book. And this is what you have in the opening. I know it feels like the world is coming to an end and that nothing we've done has changed things for the better, but evil men can't always win, and I won't give up. I'll fight for what I believe in, Christian promised. What do you believe in? Alicia asked. I believe in duty, sacrifice, love, and honor. And man, I think that says it all. And you display those. What's your book?
And I think that was from 2011.
Well, it still holds true today. And it's been an honor getting to know you. And I'm going to look forward to part two of this discussion. But let's leave it at that for today. We'll keep it short and sweet. And I think that kind of set the table for some interesting discussions moving forward.
It's always great, Pat. I can't wait to do it again. Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you and your audience.
Right on. Have a great day.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
And that concludes another episode of the Coptimizer podcast. Thank you for listening. And again, thank you for spending some of your valuable time with us. Remember, listening to others and how they optimize their lives is one thing, but to transform yourself, you have to take action. There are different paths to excellence, but to accelerate your own personal growth, I urge you to consider getting a coach. And here's why. While your time is valuable, I also want you to consider something. Your time is fixed. We know how much of it we have. Energy, on the other hand, is not. The decisions we make about how to charge and refresh our body, mind, and spirit will ultimately determine how much energy we have to invest in our time. So, to make the most of each day, we need that energy. So, if you're in law enforcement, consider getting a coach. And do so by going to axoncoaching.com, check us out, and contact us today. Until our next episode, I'm 1042.